Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 269, and we're going to have another rag and bone buffet. I've got corrections and updates and clarifications galore, so much that they are the main topic this week. We're also going to talk about ohms, and I promise you this is not in a religious sense. We'll have a product review of a remote control for your car stereo, and a place to visit that isn't quite what it seems. Hello everyone, welcome back, thanks for joining me once again. This episode is brought to you by a glass of bourbon. It's actually a cocktail I made involving some woodland bitters, bourbon, and some cherries. It's very strange. Oh, and a lime. I squeezed a lime in there too. Anyway, I haven't named it yet. I guess we could call it the Built to Go. We'll call it that. Anyway, cheers. Well, yeah, I'm glad I didn't pay for that. Anyway, let's get to business here. I've been apparently making a good number of mistakes lately, or I've said things that weren't complete or whatever, and I've had several people write to me and say, hey, that's not right, or you got this exactly wrong, or have you considered? And so I thought I would just dive in and just talk about all those things. So the first one, the one that made me think the most, was from Elliot in the UK. And I'm just going to read his note right here because I thought it was very thoughtful, and I think it's worth a little bit of discussion, although we're getting a bit far afield of van life here. But if you remember, last week, I think it was, I suggested that people go visit the Anzac Memorial in Hyde Park in Sydney. That suggestion stands. But I said some things about Anzac and its relationship to the UK and how there was this perception that Anzac and other Commonwealth countries' troops were used as cannon fodder in World War I, as seen in Gallipoli and Bohamel and places like that. Well, Elliot's from the UK, and he had a little different perspective, and he shared it with me, so I thought I would share that with you, and then we'll have a little talk about it. Elliot from UK here, loving the podcast, but wanted to make a quick comment on your mention that Anzac forces had it worse than anyone else at Gallipoli. All forces that were deployed on the Gallipoli operation had a terrible time and made a great sacrifice. This includes the British regiments, i.e. from the UK, as well as Gurkha and other Indian Army regiments. Comparing to any other theater in the First World War, Europe or the Middle East, they were treated no differently. Think of the Somme, Passchendaele, all were terrible slaughters committed by generals who hadn't kept up with and didn't know how to adapt to the rapid changes in military technology that had occurred pre-war. Machine guns and barbed wire, especially. Anyway, keep up the good work, and looking forward to the next podcast and Wren update. Elliot, thank you so much for that. I already wrote to Elliot and expressed to him that this was a very thoughtful comment. And I did a little bit of research on it, and it turns out that there is a phenomenon here where the Commonwealth countries have this impression that their troops were wasted or used as cannon fodder in these conflicts while the British troops were kept in reserve in safety. And, well, from what I can see, that is a false narrative. It does not seem to align with history completely. Now, this is a very touchy issue, and there are so many stories of unbelievable slaughters, and there are many different stats you can look at to try to analyze this. I mean, boy, Newfoundland. I mean, I have mentioned before that my family hails from Newfoundland. They had a rough time in World War I. They all signed up in the Blue Puttee and headed over, and in one day, 90% of a single regiment was wiped out. And you can see why those folks coming back home would tell tales of how we were the cannon fodder and the British didn't really do their part, blah, blah, blah. And Newfoundland especially, basically the country ceased to exist because of World War I, but there's a lot of history there. At any rate, Elliot's comment does seem to be correct. The history of World War I, as we know it, supports the idea that the British troops didn't have it any better than anybody else. They were certainly putting themselves in harm's way, and in fact, the very first major casualties of World War I were Britain's finest troops. So, it's a complex issue, and I did not word it properly. And I obviously was ignorant about it to some extent. I actually believed these stories. I also don't want to take away from people who have connections to Anzac who feel that they were mistreated. It's a complex issue. So all I'm doing right now is basically explaining that is a complex issue and that Elliot's perspective on this is worth considering. Absolutely. There was no good story to come out of there. Oh, and a Ren update, because Elliot asked. So for those who may have missed the last episode, I had to stop working on my truck camper because a family of Wrens moved in when I had the floorboards open, and they've set up housekeeping, and there are eggs in the nest, and I can't disturb them, not only for my own ethical reasons, but also it's technically illegal, because Wrens are a species of native bird that you're not allowed to move a nest. So... all right, they own the truck camper now, at least for a few weeks, and I have other plans. But the update is we did see the mother wren fly up onto the nest. I actually installed a camera in there so we could watch, but we haven't seen any movement since. Now, the camera we're using has a delay. It senses movement, and it takes a couple seconds to turn on, and it's very possible that the bird is too fast and we're not seeing it. But right now, we don't know what the status is. And unfortunately, yesterday, there was a major storm in Tiki Bago Land, and I can tell from the camera that the tarp I had completely over the truck camper has blown off, which concerns me because of the way I had it attached. And the tarp I had in the truck camper to separate the wrens from the rest of the truck camper has fallen over and is now sitting on top of the nest, which is not good. So I'm going to get down there as soon as I can and see what's going on. But I don't know. It's not looking too good for the wrens right now. I hope they made it, but we will know in a week or so, because at that point, either the eggs have hatched or they're never going to. So anyway, thank you, Elliot. And I'll keep you up to date on the wrens. I also got a note from Michael. Michael wrote me very quickly to just say that he had a terrible experience with Cooper Discovery AT tires. These tires are very common in van life. They're the very aggressive AT all-terrain tires, often with white letters that you'll see on some of the adventure rigs. And he got them on his rig, but he found that just normal everyday use, they were a pain. They were way too loud, and they wore very quickly. And, well, he gave up on them. And so he went back into my podcast and listened to my recommendation for the Nokian Outposts, and he loves them. And I'm thrilled to hear that, Michael. Thank you very much for letting me know. I love those tires. So Nokian Outposts are kind of a hybrid tire. I love Nokian tires from my own history. They use a different formula of rubber than other companies. It's meant for Finnish winters. It does not freeze. It does not harden. It stays flexible in extreme temperatures, which is a problem if you don't have those kind of tires. If you have cheap tires in the winter and it's cold enough, your tires can actually freeze and you have like solid tires, and that's no good. Nokian doesn't do that. And the Outpost tires have... well, they're designed in such a way that they're aggressive when you need them to be, but they're not aggressive when you don't need them to be. So I've done thousands of miles on these tires. Actually, I've done about 20,000 miles on my Nokian Outposts. And according to the really interesting tread wear indicator they have, it's a lot more than just a bar. It actually says in the tread how much is left. In you can read it. It says, mine says 85% right now. So after 20,000 miles, I'm still at 85% life, which on AT-style tires is really, really good. So, anyway, I'm still a big fan of Nokian Outposts. They're sitting on my van, which is sitting doing nothing, but I do not have them on my truck, as the tires that were on it were fine. But if those tires wear out, which they will eventually, I will probably get more Nokian Outposts. I like them that much. So thank you for the note, Michael. That was nice to hear. Oh, and I got a note from Trevor on Facebook after I posted the link to episode 268. And he said something that should have smacked me in the face in the first place. He said, just listening to the podcast now, not sure if this varies from region to region. I know where I live in Manitoba, dyed diesel is for farm off-road, while clear is for on-road use. I think I said exactly the opposite of that. I made a very silly mistake and reversed it, because obviously... if they're testing for dye, clear won't mean anything. The idea is that if you use the wrong fuel, you will have dyed the fuel in your tank, and that will be the telltale sign that, hey, you're using the untaxed fuel. So forget everything I said. It's the opposite of that. Off-road fuel, the cheaper fuel that has different standards and isn't taxed the same, is dyed, so they can detect the dye in your tank. Normal diesel that you'll get out of a pump at a normal station has not died on road diesel. I apologize for the error, and I really appreciate Trevor bringing it to my attention. I will always, always, always appreciate that. So if you ever hear me say anything wrong, please let me know. Ah, the Aurora Project. So it's been a long time since I've talked about the Aurora Project. This was a project I did in 2019 and then again in 2021, where I visited every place named Aurora in the United States and Canada. Now, there was only one in Canada, so that was pretty easy. And I went to them all in 2019, and then in 2021, I started to do them all again and then stopped in the middle because I came to a realization that I didn't know how to address, and it gets a little bit political. But basically, I came to the realization that my original mission, which was to find the commonality among all Americans, that we all had someone to hate. It was just different groups we hated. That was the commonality. And that was a sobering thought that made me take a step back from the project. I have not given up on turning it into something. My original thought was to turn it into a YouTube video series. And I did actually produce a few of those videos, which you can find on my page. They took an incredible amount of work and just were not popular. I was, you know, spending a week making them, and they would get 100 and 150 views. And I liked the videos. So the problem is I liked them. I think they came out the way I wanted, and nobody responded to them, and it just wasn't worth the effort. So I gave up on the video idea. But I still think there's a book or a podcast or something in here. The problem is now it's been 4 years since I last visited an Aurora, and they're a different place now. The whole country is a different place now. So I don't know how compelling it would be for me to explain my experiences and then state my conclusions based on something that happened before COVID and then after COVID and now after a second Trump administration. So what I had hoped to do was to actually do it a third time, go back out and visit every Aurora again. And this time, actually, I was going to leave an object hidden in every Aurora and then give clues on how to find it, just as a puzzle thing. But I was going to, with my new focus that this was going to be more of a narrative thing than a YouTube thing, I was going to spend more time focusing on that, talking to more people. But time has not been on my side, and this would take a lot of time. I'm having vehicle problems, and I'm also getting to the point now where I'm a little afraid to travel like that. And that should probably be its own podcast. So anyway, that's what's going on with the Aurora Project. It is still very much in my mind, and I'm taking way too long to figure out what to do with it, but I haven't given up. And on a similar vein, I started the year talking about a book I was writing about van life, and I'm happy to say that I'm back working on that book. Now that all my travel of the summer has, well, not all of it, but most of it has quieted down, and I'm no longer planning constantly for all these trips, and I'm now back at work at the book, and I'm about 75% done with the first draft, and I'm hoping to have the first draft done by the end of the month, and then, you know, go back and editing and stuff. And the book is turning out to be this interesting thing that I don't know if it exists. There's lots of van life books out there. I mean, you know, anybody living on the road has thought, hey, we should write a book, and that's fine. I mean, those are great. You should read those. Mine is different. My book is actually going to be, I hate to use the word instrument, but it is a tool for people who are considering van life. And it's basically a walkthrough of a series of questions. And based on your answers, I give you a response that will inform whether you actually do want to do van life or if you do, what you're going to come up against. It's going to be kind of a one-way interactive experience where as you read the book, you'll be challenged to think of certain things, and then hopefully by the end of the book, you'll have a really good idea of whether this van life thing is for you and what to expect. And so I'm going to self-publish this. I have no pretense of getting this thing published, whatever, and I will certainly let you know about that when it happens, but that's what's going on there, and I'm pretty excited about it. I will be very happy to get this under my belt, and then I'll move on to another book. And since we're talking about travel, I am still planning other trips. Just briefly to mention some of the other things that are going on. I'm not involved in this, but the Skeptoid group is going to Death Valley again. So if you're interested in an organized trip to Death Valley with some science-y folks, that is happening in October. You can go to skeptoid.com/events to learn more about that. The Skeptoid tours of Death Valley are... you are traveling with expert geologists who know stuff that the general tour guides won't know. Like, if you had a park ranger with you, they would be listening to the people that are in this group. So if you want a really interesting and very truthful perspective of Death Valley and some of the strange places that people don't get to see in Death Valley, that is well worth checking out. That's at skeptoid.com/events. Also, I am taking a group of people to Iberia on the world's largest sailing vessel. It is the Royal Clipper. It's a massive sailing vessel with 42 sails, and the sails are real. They actually do propel the vessel. And yes, of course, the vessel has engines too. But most of the time, or at least as much as they can, they sail under wind power. Beautiful, luxurious, and adventurous ship. Very romantic. I mean, I put up a picture of this ship, and I almost sold out the cruise just on the picture before I could even get the website out. So that's something we're doing in April of next year. It leaves from Lisbon, and then it goes down the coast and visits places like Gibraltar and Malaga. You're going to have the chance to see Europe off of the... well, let's see. It'll be Europe off of the starboard bow and Africa off of the port bow. That's pretty cool. Anyway, I'm doing that in April, and it's not an inexpensive trip, as you might imagine. But if you're interested, get in touch with me, and I'll let you know about that. There's also an option to continue on to Nice, France. So I'm very excited about that, and I'm sure you'll hear me talking about it. I'm going to Colorado in September for a private event. I'm going to Canada at the end of September to try out a brand new ship called the Allura. And I'm going to Malta in December for a week to explore Malta and really get in deep to see what Malta's about, with a day in Warsaw, of all things. So that is also very exciting for me. But yeah, that's what's coming up for me. And I know VanFest in Florida is coming up again in February. If you haven't found this out, they've announced the date. So if you go to VanFestUSA.com, you can find out about VanFest Liftoff. I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it to that. I would really like to. I don't have a rig I can travel with at the moment. But yes, that is coming, and I would like to do it. And I hope everybody who is going to the Cape Cod Fest has a great time. I am, as they say, gutted not to be able to attend that. I really wanted to go to that. Anyway. Okay, let's talk about Peregrinus. Peregrinus is another podcast I started that I had to step back from just simply due to time. Peregrinus is like my own personal writing and podcasting that is completely separate from van life. I do not separate religion and politics from that. That is all about me. That is a vanity project. And some folks are interested, some folks aren't. I totally get it. But if you are somebody who had been following Peregrinus, you notice that the podcast dropped off and then the writing has slowed way down. That's going to change. That's all I'm saying. That is going to pick back up. I just had a crazy busy summer and I had to make some cuts, and that got cut, but it's coming back. So if you are interested in my own personal stuff, and I'll tell you flatly, it is frank and opinionated, and you may not like it, but you can find it at peregrinus.ghost.io, because in my infinite wisdom, I picked a word that no one knows or knows how to spell, because, you know, that's smart. So you have to be a curious person to find it. You got to figure out what Peregrinus is and how to spell it. And finally, on this rag and bone buffet, let's get to the truck camper situation. So I am going to Colorado, and I'm going to an event, and I'm going to do wild camping, boondocking, whatever you want to call it, at 8,000 feet in the area of Gardner, Colorado. I am doing that. Nothing is going to stop me. I put my stick in the ground, and I'm going to stick with that stick. I just don't know what I'm doing yet. I bought this truck camper to be my main rig. It currently belongs to Wrens, should the Wrens decide to give it back to me, then I have to spend time fixing it. I have to put the floorboards back in. I have to remount the tie downs, which is a serious thing because that's an important part, and if I screw that up, bad things will happen. Then I have to test it on my truck and see if the truck is stable enough for a long journey, and if it's not, I have to put in sway bars, which I thought to myself, you should just put in the sway bars now, and anyway, I might get there. But I have about 4 weeks to sort this out. If I give up on the truck camper, I'm still going, but I'm going to do the no build in my truck like I talked about before, and I have been investigating that. It is going to be a real no build. I mean, I am not going to do much work at all, but it's going to be comfortable, and I've set like criteria. It has to have a comfortable bed. That's pretty easy. Refrigerator, heat, ventilation, and solar. Because of the type of trip I'm doing, I won't have a way to charge the battery other than solar, really. Now, I have a lot of this stuff anyway. It's just a matter of installing it. So the thing is, I don't want to do all this work. It's a no-build, right? So what's the work? No, there's a lot of work involved in a no-build, but I don't want to do all that if I'm going to be able to use the truck camper, because I need to use the truck as a truck for other projects. So the no build is going to be something that comes in and out, and no matter what you do for a no build, that's still a bit of work. In my case, this cap weighs about 200 pounds, and I have taken it on and off the truck myself a few times now. It is right at the limit of my abilities, and I've actually damaged the side of my truck by scraping the thing. Anyway, my goal is to not have that truck cap anymore, remove it, never put it on again, and just use the truck camper. But I can't get there yet. So anyway, those are all my updates. I'm sorry for the unusual episode, but the unusual episodes are becoming so common now that, heck, they're usual episodes now. And special thanks to Terry, who bought me 2 gallons of something nice. Thank you, Terry. And thank you to everyone else who supports me every single month through buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. This is why there are no ads on the podcast. If you would like to keep ads off the podcast and just support the podcast in general, please visit buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And that's how we make that happen. You guys have been very generous with me. I appreciate that. And I know the listeners do too. So thank you. Thank you very much. Van Life News. I found a piece of good news, but we're going to save that for the end because I have 2 pieces of not so good news first. Hey, last week we talked about the legality of van life and these new laws, and, you know, all this anti-homelessness stuff that is impacting van life. I've been talking about it forever. It's not getting any better. The bit of news this week isn't so much news as commentary from the godfather of van life himself, Bob Wells. I invite you to go to the link in the show notes or just search YouTube for Bob Wells and the legality of van life. And Bob spends a lot of time talking about it and what he thinks it means. And he's been around. He is a man of some strong political opinions. Some might say extreme. That's up to you to decide. But his takeaway from this bill is that you basically should stay out of cities. You know, it's easy for him to say. He spends most of his time out in BLM land, way out west in the U.S. But he's got a point. All this trouble with this anti-homelessness stuff that van lifers could run into is happening in cities. The bigger the city, the more trouble. So if you're somebody who is a stealth camper who wants to tour the country, and you're in kind of an older rig, I mean, it's sadly, this is all targeted. It's not like they're doing blanket stuff looking for anybody sleeping in a van. If you're out there in your brand new pleasure way, nobody's going to bother you, or if they do, it's going to be very polite. But if you're in there in your 1988 caravan with 3 different colored panels and some rust and some stuff on the roof, yeah, they're coming for you. Bob's solution is simply stay out of cities, and it's an interesting thought. So go ahead and take a look at it, and, you know, if you have some strong thoughts about it, feel free to let me know, and we can talk about it. This one is interesting. So this was in Financial Times, which is not a publication that you would think had the pulse of a van life. And it turns out, well, they don't. But the name of the article, which is probably created by the editor and not the writer of the article, is Americans Put the Brakes on Van Life. It actually says hashtag van life. So obviously this caught my attention, and I looked at the article. And what do you think the article's about? Is it about all the people leaving van life? Is it interviews with people who did van life and aren't doing it anymore? Or is it interviews with people who thought they would do van life and now they're not going? No. It's none of that. In fact, the word van life is only mentioned twice in the article, and one of those is the promo for the article. You know what's mentioned 9 times in the article? RV sales. This is Financial Times, right? They care about finance. It's an article about how RV sales have slowed. And that was the headline they used. So that makes me wonder, is there some kind of media bias against van life? I mean, yes, there is. But there's also pro-van life bias, too, depending on your media. So what's up with that headline? I think it's kind of interesting, and I will probably never have an answer. But it wasn't an article about van life. As for RV sales slowing, well, yeah, they had huge boom years, and then, you know, that's going to wane off, and that's the period we're in right now. There actually was an uptick recently in RV sales. But what does RV sales have to do with van life? I mean, yeah, there's a relationship, right? If you build out a van, you're technically making an RV. But, you know, most people buying RVs aren't doing van life, in my opinion. They're doing RV life, you know? They're camping on the weekends or a couple weeks a year and staying at campgrounds and whatever. And some of us do that, but, you know, anyway, you understand the difference, at least in my mind. Anyway, it's an interesting look at perceptions of van life, and boy, if you can come up with an idea about why they called the article that, I would love to hear it. I have a link in the show notes, but it's at the Financial Times, FT.com, and it's called Americans Put the Brakes on Van Life, which I don't see that being the case myself. And then finally, the good news article. This is in success.com, right? So success, that's good, right? It's called Embracing Van Life in Retirement. And it's a very reasonable article about one person's van life. And you can find this at success.com and just search for Embracing Van Life in Retirement. And it's the story of Mona McCoy, who found herself in 2020 during COVID watching YouTube, and she saw a guy living in a van and said, I wonder if I could do that. It might be cheaper. And she worked at a car dealership, so she was able to get a van for wholesale, and then the car dealership got sold, and she found her life was all in disarray, and then, you know, she looked, and she's like, well, I'm in my early 60s. The heck with it. And she hopped in her van and traveled the U.S. for 2 years, and she pays for all of her van life with Social Security, an emergency fund that she saved up, and a little bit of money from YouTube for her channel, This Van Life of Mine, which you should check out. And the article goes on to say that this is actually a growing trend. It's the opposite of what Financial Times said, is that more and more people are looking at retiring in their van. And now, the van she travels in is not some big fancy thing. It's an Econoline, and which is a van I particularly like. I'm sad that they stopped making them. But yeah, she's out there doing this, and she talks about the normal stuff of van life. Like, she has a recent bit about being sick in the van. That's a huge thing. She's had some incidents where someone tried to run her over, and she got rear-ended. She talks about cooking, and she talks about a very serious issue that I will let you discover for yourself. But there's a risk to living in van life that we talked about a few times. I don't want to spoil her thunder. So anyway, check her out at This Van Life of Mine on YouTube, and there's a link in the article. But anyway, that's the news. I'm going to stick with that positive bit at the end. Despite everything that's going on, van life is still offering opportunities to people who want to travel and want to do it in a way that they can, based on their resources. That still exists. People are still doing it, and don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Tech Talk. Let's talk about ohms. Yes, the OHM ohms, the resistance ohms, not the meditative ohms. Although you can meditate on this as you try to understand it, because, well, this is complicated. Multimeters. Get a multimeter. Learn how to use it. You will never learn how to use all of it unless you're really, really on the way to becoming an electrician. Multimeters do so many things that require a lot of knowledge that I don't know how to use all the features on mine. But the two that are most useful are the voltmeter part, where you can tell if there's voltage somewhere. That lets you test a circuit to see if it's live. It lets you test the circuit to see how many volts are coming out of it. And it lets you test the circuit for polarity. Those three tests are essential in van life. But there's another one that is very useful that I use, and it is testing for resistance. Ohms is a measurement of resistance, and it's named after a guy named Ohm. And what resistance means is how much is in the way of the electricity going down the wire. That's all ohms means. So if you have very, very low resistance, you will have very low ohms. And low resistance can be as simple as a solid piece of wire. Solid piece of wire will have low resistance. And if you use your multimeter and you set it to the ohm setting, if you touch the two terminals together, you will get 0.0 ohms. There is no resistance. It's a complete circuit. Now things get complicated. If you take your leads apart, you will get 0L or OL. That means open loop. Some people say it means overload, but in this regard, I think it's better to remember it as open loop, and that means there's no connection at all between your two leads. It's infinite resistance or no resistance, depending on how you look at it. But basically, OL means those two things are not connected to each other. That's pretty easy to understand, right? So 0.00 means those things are connected. 0L or OL means they're not connected at all. The problem is that those aren't the readings you're going to encounter very often. This past weekend, I had a cable fail. So at Tiki Bagoland, I have a piece of underground Romex. It's an armored cable that you're supposed to bury that carries AC currents at fairly high amps. It's the kind of cable that if you had a shed in your backyard and an electrician ran a line out to your shed, it might be what they use depending on local codes. Now, my cable is buried, and for some reason, it failed. It, like, in midday, I was sitting in the Airstream, and the power went out. I'm like, what happened? Went back, and the fuse blew. This is an older place, so there's a fuse, an actual screw-in Edison-type fuse protecting the circuit. And it blew, and I was like, well, that's weird. Now, brownouts can cause this. It was a very hot day, and it's possible that all the houses on the street were using all the electricity for air conditioning, and that caused the voltage to go down. Voltage goes down, amps go up, amps are what trips a fuse, fuse blew. Okay, maybe. So I replaced the fuse, boom, popped again instantly. Something's up. So I went back to the Airstream, unplugged the cable from the Airstream, making sure that there was nothing in there that was causing the problem. Went back, put in another fuse, boom, it popped. That means that whatever's causing the fuse to pop is in the cable. The cable is causing the fuse to pop. Now, shorting out the lines will cause the fuse to pop. So this is AC we're talking about here. We usually talk about DC. This is AC. AC, you've got three wires, usually at least. You can have more. Ground, which is an uninsulated copper wire usually. And then you've got hot and neutral. And I'm not going to talk about the colors, but they can change. Hot and neutral are the wires that will alternate in current, because that's how AC works. Doesn't matter. Just know that we have three wires. Somewhere in my circuit, two of those three wires were touching that weren't supposed to be. And it's buried cable, 225 feet of it. I don't know what happened, but I knew how to fix it. And the first step was to use my multimeter to figure out where the short was. And here's where this gets tricky. In order to figure out where there's a short in three leads of a cable, you want to sequentially attach one lead to one cable and the other lead to the other cable, record the reading, and then go down the line. Here's where I almost screwed up. I was recording the numbers of the multimeter, and some of them were like 0.8. I'm like, okay, that seems pretty high. And then some of them were like 0.02. I was like, okay, that's pretty low. And they didn't make sense, and I couldn't figure out these numbers until I realized that there was a little symbol that was coming up for the word mega. I wasn't seeing 0.8 ohms, I was seeing 0.8 mega ohms, which is a whole lot of ohms. Now, the good news is that there was a huge difference, which means that I knew there was a problem. There shouldn't be any difference. If all these wires weren't connected to each other, there shouldn't be any difference at all. So I knew there was a problem because there was a difference. But I struggled with trying to interpret this. And so ohms are bad. I mean, they're not bad. They're good in some cases. Basically, the ohms create heat. So if you have resistance on a wire, that creates heat. Like your toaster oven and many electric heaters work this way. You're basically just the resistance of the wires creating heat. And that's actually what makes fuses blow too. Once that heat gets too hot, the fuse blows before the wire burns. That's the whole point. So one of the connections had 0.8, and then one of the connections had 0.2. And I couldn't understand, like, what does that mean? 0.2 ohms, 0.8 ohms. And then I saw there was an M that lit up. It was mega ohms. 0.8 mega ohms, which is significantly different. The point of this is it's very, very confusing. But I can tell you that in my case, 0.8 mega ohms meant that there was so much resistance that these two wires weren't connected to each other at all, which meant it was an open circuit, which is how it should have been. See, if wires are running next to each other for a very long run, there will be some resistance that you can detect between them, even though they're not connected. The fields will actually just be near each other and they interact. The ones where the wires are touching, that's what's going to give you the low rating. Remember that when I put the two leads together, I got a rating of 0.00. I mean, that's two wires actually touching. To get a rating of 0.2 is very close to 0.00. And in fact, I was able to determine that, well, my red wire was touching my ground wire somewhere. I still don't know why or how. I don't see any damage. I don't see any digging. I honestly do not know what failed. But I got lucky because I actually installed the wrong kind of Romex. The Romex I installed actually had three leads and one ground instead of just two leads and one ground. So I was able to swap the red wire for the unused black wire, and now everything's fine. I'm sorry if that was super complicated, because it kind of is. But you can see the value there. Without having to dig everything up, I was able to determine which wire had the short, and then because I had run an extra wire ahead of time, through dumb luck, I was able to use that, and now the circuit is fine. Now, I could still have a bigger problem, because I don't know what caused the original short. Whatever it is, maybe there's a sharp rock cutting the cable underground as it's driven over or something. I don't know. But that could continue, in which case I'm going to have to actually dig up the wire. And I don't know of a way to use a multimeter to tell how many feet away a short is. They actually do have tools for that, but I think they're quite expensive. This stuff is complicated. It's really hard to talk about in a podcast. But now you know that you have the ability to use an ohm meter, which is one of the functions of a multimeter, to detect shorts even if you can't see the wires. And that information can be super useful if you're doing any troubleshooting. And if there are any electricians out there and I screwed up, I apologize. This stuff is complicated to think in my head. And that little M really confused me. That sure did. Product review. So in my truck, which is a very baseline kind of trim line, it had a radio that just didn't do CarPlay or much of anything, and I swapped it out, and I've talked about that. A company actually gave me the radio in exchange for YouTube review, etc., etc. It's a Junsun, and it does CarPlay. It's worked fairly well. All is fine. But the Junsun has two things that I don't like. One is that it does not have a next and back button that's easily accessible. You have to press like three buttons to get to the screen to do that, and that bugs me. The other is that the volume buttons are really not very responsive. You have to keep tapping on them over and over again. And like if my wife is talking to me and I want to be able to hear her, or I pull up to a drive-thru or whatever, it can be a pain in the butt to just lower the volume. So I thought, well, this is silly. Surely somebody makes a Bluetooth controller thing that's just those buttons, and that's it. And you hook it up to the Bluetooth, and you're done, and that's the end of it. And they do, of course, and they're especially popular with motorcycle riders. So I bought one, And I installed it, and it doesn't have much of a brand name. I'll have a link in the show notes, of course. It just says, waterproof media button, remote selfie control car, motorcycle steering wheel, music for iPhone or Android with mount. Whatever. But it was $17. It's a nice form factor. You could easily just stick it on your dashboard with a sticker, or it comes with a clip to put it on your steering wheel or your stick shift or whatever you've got in your vehicle. It runs on a regular old button cell battery, so you don't have to charge it. And you press a button, the blue light flashes, you actually connect it to your cell phone, and then you can use it to control everything on your cell phone, including take a picture. If you have the camera loaded and you press play, it will take a picture. So all that's pretty handy, and it all works great. And honestly, if that's all you need, this is a pretty good piece of equipment, and it's only $17. However, this is not a completely positive review. I found that it doesn't really do what I want. So first off, you have the problem of Bluetooth, which is a problem. Bluetooth is not a great technology. Bluetooth often fails. Things refuse to connect, and you're frustrated that you can't connect them even though you can. The two devices right next to each other, I'm sure everybody's had this experience. This thing does that too. Sometimes it just doesn't connect, which is annoying, and I don't know why we can't fix that in 2025, some, what, 15 years after Bluetooth came out? It's probably more like 20 now. So there's that, but I kind of expected that. The problem I didn't expect, and I don't know how to fix this, is that the volume buttons don't work. Because when you hook up your iPhone to CarPlay, it disables the volume buttons on your phone. And that's what these things do. They control the volume buttons on your phone. I need them to control the volume buttons on the stereo. And unfortunately, I can't find a way to Bluetooth this thing just to the stereo and not my phone. So it totally didn't solve my problem. And that explains why I couldn't find any of these on Amazon that had the word CarPlay or Android Auto in them. That apparently is a problem that no one's been able to fix, or I'm looking in the wrong place or anything. I don't know. But anyway, would I recommend this thing? Yeah, if you're not using CarPlay or Android Auto, I think it's exactly what I wanted. It's a little tiny disc that lets you control volume, play, pause, and next and forward. I think if you're somebody who has your phone in your pocket and you're riding a bike or a motorcycle, be careful when you're listening to music on those things. This would be super useful. I may just install it on my tractor where I'm just listening to my iPhone on a headset and I don't have CarPlay. I can just use it like that. That would be perfect. Or you could put it next to your bedside or whatever. It's interesting. It'd be kind of good for travel because often when you travel, you can't put your phone where you want it when you're charging it because of where the outlets are. This thing would let you do all that pause and play and all that while you were in bed, no matter where your phone was. Oh, and if you're wondering why, while I'm on the tractor, I don't just use the buttons built into whatever I'm using for headphones. The answer is that I'm wearing a Sawyer's helmet while I'm on my tractor. It's got earmuffs, and the earmuffs block that stuff. And I'm also wearing gloves, so I need big chunky buttons. Anyway, I'd call that a mixed review for this thing. It does what it says it will do. It does not do exactly what I wanted it to do. But you can check it out. There's a link in the show notes. This one is made by, Fuyita? Fuyiita. And as you might imagine, there's like 30 different ones like this. This is the one I got. It works fine. Your mileage may vary. Tales from the road. It was a while ago now, maybe 10 years ago, and I was in San Antonio, Texas with my wife. She was at a medical conference. I was just exploring San Antonio, which is still, I think, my favorite city in Texas. I like San Antonio. I've had crazy adventures there. And one of those adventures was this. So my wife and I think it was the end of her conference, and she wanted to go out to a fairly nice place for dinner. We went to a place called The Esquire, which is right near the Riverwalk. And it's an old place. It's been there since 1933. They opened up right after Prohibition. And it's one of these dark, kind of moody places. They claim to have the largest wooden bar top in Texas. And that wording is so specific that I'm sure somebody else claims the largest marble bar top or just the largest bar or whatever. But anyway, it's kind of a fun place. And they have an Artomat there. I'm a big fan of Artomats. But we had a lovely dinner. And we're walking back to our hotel, which was maybe, I don't know, a quarter of a mile or so. It wasn't a huge walk, but, you know, it was a nice walk. It was a beautiful night in San Antonio. It was like 75. We walked down the river and then through the downtown, and this guy came up and said, "Hey, can you spare some change? I'm kind of hungry." We talk about homelessness a lot on this podcast, and if you live in a major city in the U.S., you will encounter people who will ask you for money all the time. In Chicago, it can happen 5 or 6 times just in a short walk, depending on where you live. When I lived in the South Loop of Chicago, I literally couldn't walk out the building and go to any of the stores without being asked for money by somebody. Now, you can't give money to everybody, and the strategies of what to do are varied, and there's different arguments. Some people say never give them money, only give them food. Some people say don't ever give them anything. There are services available. Donate money to those services and those organizations that help them. Some give out cards, like, oh, you're hungry? Okay, here's a gift card. Except that doesn't really solve the problem, because gift cards can be sold. And what is the problem? Why not just give them cash? So what if they want to use it to buy beer? Is that your business? There are many, many, many different perspectives. But it's something you're going to run into. And I don't have a strategy every single time I renegotiate. I am positive I've been scammed a few times. I'm also positive I have been very, very helpful to people who needed it sometimes. Which is worse? Which is more important? It's tricky. But on this occasion, we decided that, you know what? We've had a good time. We're in a good mood. Probably had a little bit to drink. We said, tell you what, we will buy you a meal. And he said, oh, that's great. And before he could say anything else, he said, where would you like to get a meal from? And he said, Whataburger. Whataburger is a big chain in Texas. It has a loyal following, and they're pretty much everywhere. So I thought, oh, that's great. And I thought, for sure, we would just walk to a Whataburger, buy him whatever he wanted, and, you know, that would be it. That isn't what happened. He said, okay, how about Whataburger? And he said, and there's one right over here. And we were like, well, we don't really want to walk anymore. My wife doesn't have the greatest mobility in the world, but all right. And so we walked and walked, and we're talking with the guy, and you know, he's being a little weird, but, you know, homeless folks can often come across in strange ways. They've been through a lot. They're going through a lot. But we notice we're getting further and further out of downtown, kind of into more and more remote areas. And why? You know, my instinct would be to pull out the phone and look for the nearest Whataburger, but no, he was local. He knew where it was. But it clearly wasn't. He was leading us away from the businesses. So we're like, so dude, where is this Whataburger? And he's like, well, I think it's right up here. Whereas before, he had been absolutely sure where we were going. And so we made the decision, nope, we're done. We left the guy and said, sorry, we are out of time. And we walked back to the hotel. And we don't know what was going on. Was he just confused? Was he actually trying to lead us someplace more private so he could rob us? Was there something else? I don't know. I literally don't know. Now, I am a fairly large guy. I tend to be not the kind of person that someone's going to say, let's rob him, especially when I'm with my wife. But I don't know. I don't know what went on. And I tell this story because I don't know what the right response is. I literally don't. I have given money to people who've told me crazy stories. I've refused money to people that clearly needed the money, although I don't know how they would use it. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about, like, is how they use the money my business? You know, if we had just given this guy $5, he would have had $5. We would have went on our way. What's wrong with that? Well, what if he'd use that $5 to buy drugs? Or what if he'd use that $5 to buy cigarettes or booze? What if? He gets to live his life, you know? If you have money, you get to spend it on what you want. Well, I don't want to support that kind of behavior. Well, okay, then don't ever give anybody any money, because once you give them money, it's theirs. They can do what they want with it. It's all very complicated. And this leads to another story that I know some people would be upset with me if they knew that I did this, but I'm going to tell the story anyway. Years later, actually, I was in Boston. I was walking up the street, and there was a guy there, you know, a homeless guy asked for money. Hey, man, can you spare some change? That kind of thing. And I did, literally didn't have any change. I was like, no, I'm sorry, I can't right now. People behind me stopped and were talking with him, and, you know, not my affair. I went on, went to the store, did my little errand, came back, walked by, and they were still talking to him. And they were talking about cigarettes. And I'm like, okay. And they were very loud, and I could hear them. And the guy was like, I just want cigarettes. I'm just looking for cigarettes. If you're not willing to give me cigarettes, that's fine. But that's what I want right now. And they're like, you know you shouldn't smoke, and you have so little money. And they were just berating this guy and telling him, you know, people donate money to you. It's not for cigarettes and all this. And I actually got angry. I was angry, not at this guy who's in these dire circumstances trying to just have one comfort. I was angry at these people judging him for it. They were well-dressed, clearly were not having problems with homelessness, but they thought it was in this guy's best interest for them to berate him for his lifestyle choices as he's sitting there unwashed in old, worn clothing in a bush. And I did something that some people will not support. I went up to them, didn't say a word, opened my wallet, took out a $20 bill, and said, here you go, have a couple of packs. Which I don't actually think is enough for a couple of packs these days, but what do I know? I don't buy cigarettes. And he said, thank you. Thank you, man. And I walked off. I wasn't looking for a confrontation. I just saw that at this moment, I could do something that wouldn't have a whole lot of impact on me, but might be meaningful for this one guy. And I don't know the guy. I don't know if he was in prison for horrific crimes for 40 years and just got out and that's where he ended up. I don't know, and I don't care. There was that one moment where I saw this opportunity and I took it. I don't know that I would do it again. But hey, there's the story. You guys can figure out any meaning that comes out of that for yourselves, because I'm often just confused these days. A place to visit. This is a weird place to visit. We just went to Cape Cod and we were looking at places to stay, and we ended up staying in this church, and we actually slept in this massive bed underneath a huge stained glass window. It was very cool. But one of the other places we looked at was a place called Otto Camp. Just like it sounds, Otto Camp. I had never heard of this before, but you basically camp in Airstreams. And we're like, oh, well, that would be interesting. They've already got these Airstreams set up in a campground. You can just move in. And we're like, oh, why don't we do that? And so I looked into it. Now, I am not sure this is a place you should visit, but it's definitely a place you should be aware of, and it might be just the right place for you. Otto Camp sets up really high-end luxury campgrounds and some of the best places for campgrounds in the country, like Zion National Park, Joshua Tree, the Catskills, and yes, Cape Cod, which is a place where camping is expensive and hard to find. They've got Airstreams there for you to sleep in. I think it's pretty cool. Except, we didn't stay there, and I need to talk about the reason why. The campground is set up so that there are Airstreams, and there's other things you can sleep in as well. It's not all Airstreams, although that's their you know, their fancy thing. And then there are public buildings, and they offer picnics. They have room service. They will actually have food delivered to your thing. This is glamping, the absolute definition of glamping. There's no more glamping than this. They have cabins, too. You don't have to stay in the Airstreams. But and they actually have tents as well, these adventure tents that look very much like the kind of tents you'd stay at on a luxurious African safari. But the Airstreams, well, they gutted them. The Airstreams are basically just metal tents. There's nothing left inside from the original Airstream, because I think they think that's not luxurious or glamorous enough. So it's a regular flush toilet, which is obviously going to be welcome, but they've torn down the walls. There's no kitchen. It's not an Airstream anymore. It looks like one from the outside, but it's really not. So it wasn't really something we were interested in. However, if you're the kind of person that's looking for a pseudo camping experience in a place that's quirky and just kind of interesting, it's very photogenic. You could have some really interesting photos taken here. Take a look at Otto Camp at ottocamp.com. No, they're not sponsoring me. I've already said terrible things about them. That would never happen. But this, for certain people, at certain times of year, this might be a nice kind of a splurgy thing to do. and their locations are pretty darn good. So, just for you to consider. Resource recommendation. HomeToGo.com, which I will admit that I'm not familiar with, just came out with a list of the 100 most affordable and interesting state park stays in the United States. Now, this is particularly good timing because national parks in the U.S. right now are difficult. Let's just say that. So state parks are what I've been encouraging people to look at. And this site lists 100 state parks that you probably haven't heard of. But maybe you should, because these places generally have a lot less traffic than national parks, but they're also, honestly, almost as impressive. They're not quite as impressive. They're almost as impressive. And they're certainly a lot cheaper. They did a very good job with the methodology. In fact, in the links in my show notes here, there will be a link to the methodology page rather than just results, because you can search on it. For example, you can search on state, the price, the affordability score, the hidden gems score, the size score, how good the trails are, how good the wildlife is, how scenic it is, or the total aggregate score, which is what they use to rank these things. And what's interesting is if you sort by state, you can see that some states are very well represented and some aren't. For example, Alabama, one DeSoto State Park, that's all they've got. But Arkansas has three. Arkansas has Petit Jean State Park, Lake Catherine State Park, and Crater of Diamond State Park. But California, massive state with all this, no, they've only got one. And it's probably something you've never heard of. It's Pfeiffer Big Sur State Park. So always the Big Sur. Florida's got a bunch, but there's some states that have none. Vermont. All the beauty in Vermont and the relative sparseness of Vermont, they don't have a state park that makes the list. Massachusetts also does not have a state park that makes the list. And this one's really surprising. Colorado does not have a state park that makes the list. Now, there's reasons for this in some cases. Colorado obviously has some of the most amazing parks in the world. They're just not classified as state parks. Garden of the Gods in Colorado Springs, obviously, absolutely stunning place, but it's owned by the city, so it's not a state park, it's a city park. It is an absolutely stunning city park. It's just mind-blowingly beautiful for a city park, but it's not a state park, so it's not entirely fair, but it was interesting to me. Personally, Illinois has three, and they're all near me, and I've been to two of them. Starved Rock State Park, the most famous park, state park in the state by far, and also nearby and so sadly overlooked is Matheson State Park. Matheson State Park is a 5-minute drive from Tiki Bago Land, and it is a stunning wilderness of gorges and exposed rock faces and rivers and waterfalls and tall trees, and it's on the list, and it's amazing, and people don't know about it. There's also Rock Cut State Park, which sounds good, but I've never been there. Anyway, bottom line is, it's a great list of places to stay that you probably haven't heard of and that you should consider, and they're all fairly affordable. So I have the link in the show notes. It's at hometogo.com/united-states/states-parks, and you can find the list there, and there's some cool stuff here. I guarantee there's stuff here you haven't heard of, and that if you visited, you would have an amazing, amazing time. Well, folks, thank you for listening to this rather long episode 269. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. If you need to get a hold of me for any reason, you can reach me at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And until next time, remember the words of M.A. Calloway, who said, "Tides keep their time where clocks cannot. They answer to the moon's pull, not the hands of man."